And so the story begins with a beautiful heavenly butterfly named Hallie Grace. Butterflies represent colors, joy, and change, and this story has it all. Hallie Grace was born with a rare genetic connective tissue disorder called junctional epidermolysis bullosa. EB is often called the worst disease you've never heard of. Although her earthly trip was short, her journey continues to fly high. Honey butterfly warrior, warrior. You were never meant to live like us. You were made to be stronger than anyone could when made from dust. You were fearfully and wonderfully made. Welcome to the Grace, Grief, and Grit podcast. I'm Dee Daniels, joined on this episode by Joe Davis, and very excited to welcome our guest on this episode, Dr. Peter Marinkovich, an associate professor of dermatology, faculty member of the program in epithelial biology and the Stanford Cancer Biology Program. Also, a ton of research with epidermolysis bullosa and autoimmune blistering diseases, psoriasis, and skin cancer as well. So we've got a lot that we can talk to you about, Peter. Welcome to the podcast. Thank you so much for sitting down and joining us.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
I like to start, if you don't mind, Joe, and let's talk a little bit about your introduction with Peter and when you got to hear him speak and how this has certainly been a topic that we want to sit down and talk with him about and why this is so important that we dive into kind of the research behind what's going on and what's been going on.
Yeah. So Ann and I had the very fortunate opportunity to hear Peter speak in Seattle at EBRP's big research summit. And this was the first time I knew gotten to hear Peter's name, and he put on a very good presentation on EB and his involvement in Vyjuvek and how that worked. And it was, I took a bunch of notes on it and I got super nerdy about it because it was really, really interesting and really fascinating. And we spoke very briefly at the next night at their gala event, and then we had the very fortunate opportunity to meet Peter again in Atlanta at Deborah's conference, where I'm not going to get the name right, but he was basically awarded a lifetime achievement award from Deborah from all of his work in the EB community. So we just kind of connected that way, and he has graciously agreed to be on our podcast to kind of pick his brain a little bit and just, you know, get more information out in the open.
That's fantastic. Peter, I'd love for you to talk a little bit about your introduction to epidermolysis bullosa. I mean, obviously that's something we talk about a lot here on this podcast, is, you know, how you first got introduced to this and why it is a passion of yours.
Sure. Well, when I've always been interested in this type of a skin cell structure called the basement membrane. And when I was an undergraduate, I was studying collagens and laminins and trying to understand how they helped cells to move and attach. And so I, as I was starting to look around for a dermatology program, I went to, I did an elective in Oregon, and I found that I really loved dermatology. And at the same time, too, I got to know this person, Robert Bergeson, who's doing this really interesting research on the basement membranes and on a new collagen that he had just discovered called type 7 collagen or collagen 7. And they are just understanding that it was the protein that was absent and affected in the patients with dystrophic epidermolysis bullosa. And he said, well, we have this new antibody that we don't know what it recognizes, but it seems to be a major protein that keratinocytes produce and put onto their culture dish. And And I said, well, that sounds really interesting. So I started working on it, and I took on a project, and I did my research basically in Robert Bergeson's lab. And so it turns out that the protein that we were working on turned out to be, eventually we called it laminin 332. At first we called it calanin. Calanin is actually the bindings that hold Prometheus onto the rock, you know, in Greek mythology. And so this protein actually holds cells onto the basement membrane or onto the culture dish. And so I thought it was kind of a cool name. But then later, once the genes were cloned and it was found that it was a laminin, we had to change the name to laminin 332. At any rate, though, that my job is that as the one doctor, the MD in the group, is I had to figure out what types of diseases this new protein, calanin or laminin 332, was involved in, and what kind of blistering processes. So found that it was involved in junctionally B. I did some work with a French group, and together with Bob, we discovered that this French group had discovered this protein called nisine. And it turned out that I was able to show that nisine and laminin 332 were the same thing. And so after getting involved in junctional EB, and also through Bob's work with the collagen 7 and dystrophic EB, when I started my dermatology residency, I just naturally started gravitating towards blistering diseases. And I thought that it would be a great thing to do to like combine my research and my clinical specialty interests in just one area of blistering diseases. And so that's what kind of got me involved. And I just started seeing some EB patients up there in Oregon. And I just was just really inspired. I'm always inspired talking to EB patients and trying to understand where they're coming from. And I just have been working in EB ever since. And that's a major focus of what I want to do now, is just help EB patients and help the community.
I feel like we hear that a lot from those that are really locked into the research and what's going on, is how important each patient's story is. And I'm curious, when you've been able to get to know an individual that is dealing with EB and a family that's dealing with that, I would imagine you've seen every case seems to be different. Everyone seems to have something unique about what's going on with them. And I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about why that is, why everyone is so different, and why, and how important that is to learn each patient's, you know, own individual story.
Well, yeah, every patient is different from the standpoint of like their own personality and what their interests are and what their life is like. But I find that, you know, EB patients, despite, you know, the disabilities that they have, you know, with their hands and their skin, and they by and large just don't let that get in their way of what they want to do. You know, I know this one patient who is one of the best video game people on different types of like Fortnite, for example. He can actually outdo people that have totally good hands.
Oh, wow.
And he would actually stream with him actually beating people, so that you can see that he was doing it with his mitten hand deformity. And he amassed a huge number of following online, and it was really incredible. I mean, I had another patient who would drive a red Mustang, and she just really loved that car. And she didn't have much use of her hands either, but she could, with a knob, she could just really drive that thing beautifully. you know, so I just met a lot of just wonderful EB patients. And, you know, sometimes, you know, they get these cancers and then they pass away and it's very sad. And, but what I take from every time I meet with them is it makes me want to go back in the lab and work harder to find better therapies. And I get people from my group, my lab, especially people who aren't part of the clinic, but who are part of the research lab. I make sure that they get a chance to see the patients too, because they also are inspired by them. And so every patient is different, like you say, but there are certain things that are pretty common as well, you know, like these types of scarring and the blistering that can happen and the type of impact it can have inside the mouth and on the skin. So that kind of stuff is, there's a lot of repeating patterns there, but the individuals are all very unique and special, for sure.
Joe, we've talked a lot recently about the development of skin cancer for some EB families, and you know, that's something that I think we've been very curious about, you know, figuring out how that comes about, and I don't think a lot of people know that that's also yet another concern that comes along, and that's something that we've been very interested in sort of digging into that.
Yeah, there. It used to be that patients with severe dystrophic EB would mostly die during infancy and childhood due to infections and sepsis, but now that we have better ways to be able to treat the infections and better wound care, now most of the patients are living longer into their second and third decades of life. But now they're encountering another problem, and that's squamous cell carcinoma. And it's not the same kind of squamous cell carcinoma that non-EB patients get. That is kind of just more of a, it's less of a problem. It can be excised and people can get rid of it pretty readily. This is the kind of cancer that once it starts, it can be quite invasive and quite recurrent and require, you know, amputation sometimes and be very aggressive. And actually it's the main source of mortality now in dystrophic EB patients. And it's kind of sad too. The patients, you know, they have to suffer from wounds all their life and pain, only to in the back of their mind worry that one of these days they're going to get one of these skin cancer, these cancers. And as far as how it forms, we're still trying to work out the details of how it does form. But it is known that, for example, in the breast cancer literature, there's a type of breast cancer that has fibrosis associated with it or scarring associated with it that is much more aggressive than the kinds of breast cancer that does not have scarring or fibrosis associated with it. And from that, people have been able to identify little receptors on the breast cancer cells that will sense the stiffness of the environment outside the tumors. And then they transmit those signals through those little receptors called integrin mechanotransducer receptors into the nucleus, and they actually will drive pro-invasive signaling. So basically, the stiffer the matrix is around these cancer cells, the more they want to invade and more dangerous they can be. And so most of the researchers today, we feel that the same thing is going on with squamous cell carcinoma in RDEB, and that is the fibrosis and the scarring that's associated with the healing. Over time, it sort of builds up more and more to the point where it starts to, you know, drive some of these cancers and cause them to be so invasive.
Well, that was, I did not realize that cancer is now becoming the number one factor in mortality with those with RDEB. That's heartbreaking. Like you said, Peter, you live your whole life having to deal with all these wounds. You have to figure out how to take care of the wounds, and then all the other complications that come with that, only then to suffer from skin cancer as well. That's really eye opening to me. And that hits me a lot on that one.
Yeah, it's a sad thing.
Well, but
some of the therapies that we're developing, some of the potential long-term effects actually could impact the cancer, and that's what we're hoping to be able to show as we sort of test these therapies more in the long term.
Right. Would you be able to provide any history on EB, like as the condition or the disease as a whole, like roughly, you know, how long have we even been, have we known that this has been a thing in existence?
Yeah, sure. EB, the term epidermolysis bullosa, was first coined and it was first recognized back in 1875 by this German doctor named von Hebra. And they recognize that there's a group of patients that have blistering starting at birth, and that this was an inherited type of a disease. Then over the course of about 50 years from 1875 to around 1920s or so, the different subtypes of EB were identified. There was EB simplex, which was shown to be a disease that affects the blistering inside the epidermis. Then there was junctional EB, which was discovered by Hurlitz, found middle of the basement membrane type of blistering. And then dystrophic EB was also recognized during that time. And then, so the clinical aspects of EB were just beginning to be appreciated. And then in the 1950s, there was an advance in people discovered electron microscopy. And with electron microscopy, they were able to identify what are the structures in the basement membrane that are affected in EB. And so it was found that dystrophic EB had defective anchoring fibrils, and that the blistering occurred kind of below the basement membrane in the superficial dermis. And then the positions of where junctional EB blistered was identified in EB simplex. So the electron microscopy really helped us to kind of validate the categorization of these different types of blistering diseases. And then we identified different structures within the basement membrane from electron microscopy, like anchoring filaments. So it turns out that later on, the anchoring filament protein was found, one of the major ones was found to be laminin 332, this protein that I was working with. And that the anchoring fibril protein was found to be collagen 7, which is what Bob Bergeson and his group were working on when I got there. So from the electron microscopy, then there was the biochemistry, which identified these different proteins that were components of these attachment structures in the basement membrane. And then we had to clone the genes that were coding for these proteins. So by the time we had discovered the laminin 332 and the collagen 7, then we developed antibodies against these proteins. And then we tested the antibodies in the EB patient skin. And so we knew by that point that laminin 332 was the protein that was affected in most junctional cases, and collagen 7 and dystrophic, just at the protein level. But then other folks, like for example, Yoni Uito and his group were the one of the main leaders in identifying these and cloning these new genes for the codes for collagen 7 and codes for laminin 332. And they identified mutations in these genes. And then they basically confirmed what we had found from the biochemistry, that these proteins were absent from these different cases of EB because of the mutations in the gene. And that was when we demonstrated the full, you know, defect of what was going on in these patients. And then that opened the door to development of gene therapy. Once we knew the genes that were affected, then the potential for gene therapy was there. And that was like in the 1990s. And then since that time, we've been trying to develop different types of gene therapy approaches, like different types of vectors. And there's been a lot of setbacks. You know, certain vectors didn't work very well. Others caused a lot of side effects. And so we tried many different types of vectors and got better and better at it. And so now we're at the point now where we're testing those gene therapy vectors in clinical trials. And in at least one gene therapy, we finally got approval for it here in the United States for the topical gene therapy called VYJUVEK in last year, the summer of last year. So that's kind of from 1875 to present time. That's kind of the brief rundown of EB.
Wow, that was really awesome for me. So I don't know how many people are going to listen to this, and I don't know how many people are going to nerd out with that stuff. But that was really enlightening. So from 1875 until 1990, we knew what EB was. We knew the different types, but we just didn't know like what actually was going on because we didn't have the gene discovery of it all. And then, wow, that's incredible.
Well, we kind of knew what was going on when we discovered the proteins because we could tell that the proteins were absent in the skin. But then the cloning of the genes and discovering mutations, that opened the door for us to be able to do the gene therapy.
Right. Okay. So in line with that, what has been some of your biggest hurdles in doing the research in the amount of time that you've been involved?
Well, one of the things that set us back for a while was some setbacks in the gene therapy field. For example, we were working with a retrovirus to deliver collagen 7 gene to dystrophic EB patients. But back in the early 2000s, there was a group of patients that had been treated with the retrovirus to treat the severe combined immunodeficiency. It's sort of like the bubble boy syndrome, you know that one?
Uh-huh.
And so they treated the blood cells with the retrovirus containing the gene to correct that disease. But then some of the patients developed leukemia. And it turns out that the retrovirus was shown to be sometimes, occasionally, rarely, cause cancer, so that the retrovirus can insert into the host genome, but it inserts randomly. It can insert anywhere. It can insert right into an oncogene or a tumor suppressing gene, and then alter the balance of cancer. And so when that happened, that kind of set the whole field back. And then our group was just, we kind of switched over to looking at non-viral gene therapy and other types of gene therapies. But it turns out that nothing really worked as well as the retroviral, at least at the time. And so we finally decided, well, let's go to the FDA and ask them, is it okay to use the retroviral? And the way we did it was we made these sheets, autologous patient skin cell sheets that had the corrected skin cells in them that was corrected using a retrovirus. And we told the FDA, you know, if we do see cancer, it'll arise in these sheets and we'll be able to see at the superficial, you know, the surface of the skin if any cancers are forming. And if we do see them, we can easily cut them out. It's much more easy to cut out a cancer out of the skin than, like, say, get rid of a leukemia where you can't just sort of remove it out of the blood. So the FDA thought, okay, well, that sounds reasonable. And they, you know, weighed the risk benefit and they said, okay, go ahead and do it. And so now it took a while, but now therapy is currently being evaluated in the phase 3 trial. And the FDA, this could turn out to be the second gene therapy past the VYJUVEK. So at any rate, that there was some setbacks from side effects using these retroviral vectors. And that's what we call ex vivo gene therapy, where we take patient skin cells and we take them take a biopsy from the patient, and then we grow the skin cells in the test tube in the lab, put the gene into them, and then we graft the cells back onto the patient. So that's the ex vivo. There's another kind of gene therapy called in vivo gene therapy, where we take the therapy and we don't bother getting biopsies or anything. We just put the therapy right on the skin, right on the tissue. That's what the Vyjuvek is. So the Vyjuvek is the first gene therapy that in vivo gene therapy that you can redose. And that's a major advance. There was a lot of setbacks in vivo gene therapy for a long time. What happens is that all these in vivo gene therapies are used viruses to deliver the genes. And so you put the gene in of interest in the virus, and then you put the virus into the body. And one of the problems is that our body's immune systems, the main job of our body's immune systems is to fight foreign viruses and cause reactions and cause severe immune reactions to try to get rid of that virus at all costs. And so there was a patient back in the about 20 years ago or so that had genetic liver disease, and they put an adenovirus containing the correct gene back in the patient, and the patient actually died from such a severe type of immune reaction to the in vivo gene therapy. So that really set the field of gene therapy back a long time. And finally, people are starting to use gene therapy in the last few years. And now they've actually been using in vivo gene therapy more successfully in certain indications, like in the eyes, for example, and in the blood. And they're doing it, though, by just giving it to the patient once. They can only give it one time through this kind of a virus called adeno-associated virus. It's not quite as immunogenic as the adenovirus that killed that patient before. But still, you can only give the gene one time. If you give it a second time, then the memory of the immune system remembers that virus and then has already developed an attack system to be able to create severe inflammation. So you can only do it once. So with the Vyjuvek, we used a different virus, and this is called HSV-1, or the cold sore virus, basically. And so the thing about the cold sore virus is that it has developed in a way to evade the immune system. And that's illustrated in the fact that we can, get a cold sore and then it'll go away. And then a few months or year, even years later, it can come up again. And that also, nobody's been able to develop a vaccine against the cold sore virus. And it's not without trying. A lot of people have tried and failed. So both of those things are kind of illustrate the idea that the HSV-1 can evade the immune system and the immune system can't get rid of it, which is bad if you have herpes. But if you can make the herpes replication deficient, like if you stop it from being able to replicate and then you put a gene into it, then it will. We all know that herpes does a very nice job of infecting skin cells. It's very infective of skin cells. And then if you put it in the body, then the immune system won't get rid of it and won't develop a reaction against it. So then you could just give it repeatedly. And that's the beneficial aspect of this herpes virus is that you can repeatedly dose. And that's what we did in the Vyjuvek trials. We gave it weekly for 6 months. And now we've actually given it weekly for up to 4 to going on 5 years. So that's another limitation of the in vivo gene therapy that was overcome but using this virus. And I expect that in the next couple of years, there's be a lot more people that'll be using this HSV-1 virus because it does have these advantages of being able to be redosable.
Just hearing you talk about that, Peter, like in my mind, whenever y'all figured out this virus can do this type of work for EB, I could imagine everybody's just jumping around super excited because it sounds so promising and so amazing. And my, and that's my head, you know, when you, that I had this mental image of when y'all kind of figure this out, that is that there's like this big party almost.
Well, I mean, it is exciting. You know, there, when I was an undergraduate, you know, working in the lab, you know, I remember making the little tiny discoveries. And, you know, you, when you do that and you find something out that nobody else has figured out before, it's just, it's like a, you get like this thrill, this kind of exhilaration, like, wow, nobody's been able, I've been able to figure this out. And it's almost infectious. So once you get it, you know, then you're like, you're hooked. And right. you're, that's what I try to do with my students. You know, when I get them in the lab or in the clinic and get them to do research, I try, I hope that they can, you know, make some discoveries and get some good results, because then it takes a certain person to really kind of get into research. But then once they get that encouragement and the new discoveries, then it can kind of help to carry them through a research career, you know, and sustain them.
That's awesome. Yeah, I was going to say, because I mean, you kind of need those little highs, because, you know, it sounds like you go through long periods of dead ends and frustration, and then once you get that little high on that one discovery, it's like, all right, okay, it's not hopeless. Let's keep going and moving forward.
Yeah, a lot of research is, you know, you have to sort of take the failures along with the positives, and there's a lot more failures than there are positives, that's for sure.
Right.
But one of the things that you need to do, though, is if you have a failure, you can't just keep trying to overcome the failure, doing the same thing over and over again, hitting your head against the wall. Really, what you need to do is you need to understand, why did it fail? Why didn't it turn out the way I thought it turned out? And so sometimes a failure can actually be telling you something. And so I've learned this after a number of years, but finally I've learned that, you know, when you have something that doesn't go right, a lot of times it can actually be a benefit, because you just try to figure out why it didn't go right. And then once you figure that out, you learn something new.
Well, one of the listener questions that we've had over a season and now into our second season, Peter, has been regarding why it's been very difficult for a medical team to diagnose someone with EB. Why has that been a problem, and is that getting easier to diagnose? I would imagine that it is. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, before we had the genetic analysis, and up until recently, actually, the first line of therapy of the first line of diagnostic testing was to, first you do clinical, you look to see, you know, certain clinical characteristics that patients with like the EB simplex and the junctional and dystrophic patients have. Like the dystrophic patients have scarring, simplex patients don't, and junctional patients kind of in between. And there's certain things that can help diagnose junctional, like, for example, enamel, hitting of the enamel, that's pretty specific for junctional. So there's some clinical clues that can help you along the way, but you definitely have to get some kind of a molecular confirmation. And initially what we would do is we would get biopsies of the patient and test it by electron microscopy or another kind of microscopy called immunofluorescence microscopy. And that'll give us an idea as to where the level of the split is. And if we're lucky, it can also show like an absence of a particular protein like laminin 332 or collagen 7. And then we could say, okay, you probably have this type of EB. But then, you know, once we got the genes and then we're able to, and then Dr. Uedo and his group sort of made the mutation analysis sort of the standard ultimate type of a way to be able to make the diagnosis. And now there's like been even more advances in the area of genetic diagnosis, to the point where you can just get like a buccal swab sent to your house, and then you could send it, you know, your doctor orders a swab, you swab your mouth, you send it in to the genetic testing service, and then they could test all the different genes that you have. That, you know, if you're, you could tell whether you're simplex, junctional. There's like 26 different genes that can be tested at one time. It's called whole exome. And the cost is, and the speed, cost is going down, the speed's going up and getting faster. And so now there's like free genetic analysis that's available. Like Krystal Biotech in the United States has this free genetic testing kit where you get the swab sent to the patient's house, and then they'll get the results within a 2-3 weeks for free. So one of the problems before that was that a lot of times we'd order a genetic testing and the insurance companies would say, well, what do you need the genetic testing for? And, you know, we'd have to sort of kind of barter with the insurance companies, like, well, you know, we need it to test prognosis, or we need it to test for family planning. And you have to justify, and the, you know, there's a lot of back and forth with, and then some doctors will just give up, you know, and that's what the insurance companies are looking for, is like doctors that just give up, and then they don't have to pay for the test. I personally hate dealing with the insurance companies, but when I do, I try to fight them. I feel like this is some good that I can do, is fighting the insurance companies, get the testing for the patients, and I feel good afterwards. But it's just, sometimes it just feels like an unnecessary burden of our healthcare society, the way it's structured right now. But at any rate, that, I think insurance issues kind of led to the lack of genetic testing over these last 20 years or so. And then currently only about less than half of the patient, EB patients in general, have a genetic diagnosis. But now that's changed with the advent of this new home testing that can be done for free. That it's called Krystal. It's a Krystal Biotech test that's available, and I'm certain there'll be other tests, free genetic testing that's available as well from other sources for other diseases. So it's getting better than it used to be, but those have been the main limitations.
It's interesting that you mentioned about how difficult it's been with the genetic testing. I participated with a webinar by Juvec, and they had two EB patients that are on the medication, kind of giving their testimony about their life and how that medicine has been working for them. And one of the individuals, I'm guessing he's probably in his 20s, just recently got officially diagnosed with RDEB. Like, he's been living like this and he's on this medication, but just recently he had genetic testing done to officially diagnose him. And I thought that was, when he said that, I was very shocked. I would assume that he would have had that testing done a long time ago. And it's interesting you say that there's still that struggle to get proper testing. But I'm glad to hear that there's Krystal Biotech and has got that home test, and there's other methods coming out.
Yes, and the situation in the United States is pretty good. In Europe, they've always done a pretty good job as far as like genetically testing their EB patients. But there's lots of other areas of the world where there's not good genetic testing, like China, Africa. And so a lot of the different countries now are wanting to get involved in, you know, get gene therapy for their patients too. And what I tell them is, you know, while people are working out the regulatory approvals that are necessary for all the individual countries, what the doctors can do while they're waiting for that is to start genetically testing their patients and develop these types of systems where you can get like a swab, send them out to different populations and characterize your genetic population. I was just in Brazil last year, and they did an amazing job. They had this swab that they sent out to patients all across Brazil, even out into the Amazon, you know, on boats, they delivered these buccal swabs, and they were able to characterize over 400 EB patients that way. Wow. Across the country. It was quite incredible. And so I think that model is a good one to be able to utilize all around the world. I'm working actually in Africa to try to help the doctors there to characterize EB patients. And so I think that's what a lot of these countries need to do first is get the genetic diagnosis, and then they'll be in a perfect position to be able to start taking advantage of these different types of gene therapies when their countries approve them.
That's amazing. Yeah. I think that's one of the things we talk about too, Joe, on this podcast is the access that people have to not only the therapies that are available, but, you know, knowing what's going on and being able to just, that's been an uphill battle and still is for a lot of folks. But this is one of those moments where, you know, talking to Peter, this gives us a little bit of hope on the horizon, you know, about what's going on.
Yeah. So when Hallie was born, and this is, we've talked about this a lot, you know, and I don't know if you know this, Peter, but Anne was classified as advanced maternal age with Hallie. So she had all the necessary genetic testing done. And that is, an EB is not something that they test for with mothers.
Yeah, it's so rare that it's not included in the, you know, the standard screening.
Yeah. And not that it would have changed anything, but, you know, that's one of the most terrifying things that can happen as a parent is when your child's born and there's blisters on their skin and you don't know why. And then we hear so many stories ourselves, and I know you've heard where the medical staff is not aware of EB, have never seen it. They may have heard of it, but they don't know how to treat it. And things just don't go well at that point. But if you have all the necessary screenings, it puts people in a better position to make good decisions about their family, about how to navigate something that's going to be really, really difficult. They know it. They know ahead of time.
Yeah. I hear you on that. And there's a lot of hospitals that aren't familiar, and doctors that aren't that familiar with EB. You know, a lot of doctors kind of shy away from EB because the patients are so complex. And in the end, there's not a lot, up until recently, there's not a lot that you could do for them. And so for that reason, well, for many reasons, we've formed like these tertiary referral centers where there's only like a handful of hospitals around the country that actually are familiar with EB and can treat it. And we have these teams that can help with nutrition, dilating the esophagus, help with the eye erosions, ophthalmologists. We have hand surgeons that can help with the hand surgeries. So we have like these specialized, what we call multidisciplinary teams. But then out in between these centers, all the doctors and hospitals don't really know EB so well. It's one of the things I hope about with this Vyjuvek is that we'll get more pediatricians and general dermatologists interested in EB and able to treat them. I think now that they have at their disposal a therapy that potentially could help these patients, my hope is that a lot of doctors that live far away from like the tertiary referral centers would be able to help patients in these areas, at least get them, you know, treated, get them the wound care that they need and give them the Vyjuvek. And in that way, they'll at least be able to help them in their day-to-day activities. They'll still need to go to the tertiary centers once in a while to be able to get, you know, screened for, you know, skin cancers and get their esophagus and hands worked on. But still, it would be, my hope is that there'll be more physicians out in the local communities familiar with EB. And as I'm writing prescriptions for Vyjuvek, that's kind of what I'm doing is for patients that live far away. I'm trying to have them identify primary caregivers that can then I can pass the baton to help start to give the VYJUVEK themselves and then develop a familiarity with EB so that the next EB patient that comes in their office, they won't shy away from it, you know, be able to, you know, have some familiarity and be able to treat.
Absolutely. I think that's really, that's really good to hear, because we had to take Hallie to Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and
that's an excellent hospital.
We loved it. We loved their staff. Dr. Melissa Perman still is in touch with Anne, and their staff is incredible. And we, but you know, we got the opportunity to go to get Hallie looked at, but it, you know, we live in Savannah, Georgia, and it's like, well, how do we get our 2-month-old up to Philadelphia? It's like, we can't go on a, it's like, do we put her in an airplane? Do we drive? Do we, you know, we ended up taking the train because we figured we'd get the big sleeper cab and we could lay her out and do all her bandage changes there. But I mean, not everybody can do that. The tertiary clinics are great, but it's also can be a real struggle to get to those places to see the experts.
Yeah, that is very true.
I actually want to ask you something that just popped up in my head for a question. So in the 3 years that we've been in the EB community, Anne's been very active with the community, with those that are with living with EB, those with parents that have lost their child to EB. And one of the things that seems to be kind of what we've noticed to be common with severe JEB is when the child is first born, they present very mildly. Our daughter had presented very mildly. The dermatologist thought clinically she presented like she had simplex, and we've heard that from other parents that have lost their child to severe JEB that they presented very mildly. And I was wondering if you could speak to that. Is that like true? Is that a thing, or is that just kind of like coincidence that we've come across?
No, that can happen. Especially I've seen it in junctional, and it can also happen in dystrophic. Sometimes, you know, patients will get like a congenital absence of the skin, like a foot during the birthing process will lose a bunch of skin, or in utero. But often in utero, it's kind of a protective environment where the patients are in this sort of a liquid, very protective environment. So they don't get the blisters until they get out. And then once they're born, you know, they're treated very gently, they're not going to get the blistering right away. And it's just after they start to encounter, you know, people start to handle them, use tape, that's when they realize the skin is super fragile. But if you take really good care of these junctional patients and other types of EB patients, you know, they don't get the blistering right away. But then it sort of manifests itself over time. With junctional, the severe junctional, one of the problems is, you know, you can try to keep the skin on if it's a severe problem, but they can get, once they start nursing and they start to develop oral erosions, and then they can get like a kind of a hook or involvement in their throat that can eventually start to close the throat up because of swelling and the edema inside the throat. And so, you know, that junctional, even though the skin may not be as bad as you might expect it to be, it's like what's going on internally, which really is the most devastating part of that, the severe junctional disease. And that's why it's so often fatal, unfortunately.
Are you able to explain, and honestly, this is a question for myself, Peter. Are you able to explain at all how internally severe junctional patients, how it affects the internal component so badly for severe? I mean, do y'all know that? Do you know that? Or are you Can you take guesses as to why it's such a problem with severe junctional?
Well, what seems to happen, I think, with just experience, just working with these patients and, you know, and also the combined knowledge of many doctors who work with these patients, as we've, you know, sort of collectively talked about it, tried to understand it. And also there's mouse models. We were actually working with a mouse model of junctional abuse. We're trying to use it to develop some new therapies. But what seems to happen is that one of the most serious consequences is that the mouth starts to get sores inside the mouth, really painful sores, and that interferes with eating, and you get what we call failure to thrive. So the patient is just not able to eat as much as they would like. And if you recognize it early, you can actually give the patient a feeding tube and help to kind of overcome that part of the problem. But then that buys you some time. But what happens then is you also have deeper down in the throat, like right above the larynx, when the patient's coughing or crying, that creates a lot of friction inside the throat. And then you get, and it's really fragile without the severe junctional without the laminin 332. And that causes inflammation where you have the sores inside of the throat. And then that starts to create edema inside the throat, and it actually can close the airway. And so a lot of the junctional patients, they can die of this kind of like a sudden infant death type of syndrome where they just stop breathing. That I think is one of the major sources of mortality in these patients right now. So what we're trying to do is develop an ex vivo kind of gene therapy where we can put the laminin 332 gene back into the mucosal cells and then be able to implant them onto the open areas of the trachea and have these gene corrected laminin 332 expressing keratinocytes kind of spread out inside the throat. It's something we're just still working out at the animal level, but that would, if we can get it to work, then we would talk to the FDA about trying to do a compassionate use in some of these really severe hurtless patients that are born in the near future, because otherwise it's very commonly a fatal disease, unfortunately.
I appreciate you answering that question the way you did, because it's very, very familiar with what we went through. Hallie actually had she had two teeth come in at 2 months old on the bottom, and which is incredibly rare. That's not supposed to happen in babies. And we definitely think that impacted the way that she was able to feed. I think we saw some sores in the roof of her mouth. And so all of that, what you said, really makes sense to me. And personally speaking, I haven't been able to get to a point where I could ask those questions. So I appreciate you being able to answer that question for me.
Yeah, I've worked with a number of these really severe junctional patients and tried my best to try to help keep them going, and have failed multiple times, because it's such a terrible disease. Yeah.
Well, before we wrap up, Peter, my last question is, you've mentioned some of the therapies and some of the things that you're working on. What else are you expecting or what do you see on the horizon as far as, things that we can sort of look towards and keep our eyes on with therapies that are hopefully, coming down the pipeline?
Well, I think that, being able to use the collagen 7 gene like we did for dystrophic EB, it'd be nice to be able to start to use it in other diseases, especially junctional EB. Delivering laminin 332 is something that I think would be really important. And each disease is going to need a different type of a delivery method. The HSV-1 may not work so well for junctional. as it does for dystrophic. So finding newer and different types of gene carrying devices will be important for people to study. Being able for the dystrophic, I'm interested to start to use the topical gene therapy for mucosal surfaces. There was a paper that came out in the New England Journal about a month ago that showed that the use of Vyjuvek in the eye of dystrophic patients actually improved the eyes quite a bit and actually dramatically improved the patient's vision. It was just a single patient. So I'd like to see more patients get it in the eyes, as well as start to treat the mouth and the esophagus with the topical gene therapy with slightly different formulations. And then I think also with simplex and the dominant diseases with involving keratins and some of the other genes, there's a lot of people that are working on CRISPR-Cas or gene editing. And I think that's going to be an important future application as well in being able to do the gene correction in especially in diseases like simplex, where it would be particularly applicable, but also other diseases too. So I think it was difficult, and it, like I talked to you about the history of EB, there's just so much that was done to build the foundation for where we are now, you know. And so at this point, the field is gaining more exponentially. And I expect that we're going to have a number of new therapies coming out in the next few years to give our EB patients a lot more options, which is a great thing.
Yeah,
it is a great thing, Peter. And I guess maybe my last question might be, how has things changed in your field in EB over the last 10 years?
Well, not a lot has changed, except for, from a clinical standpoint, I would say the two things that have changed, I think that are the most significant, are the easier and easier ability to do genetic analysis with this invention of this whole exome sequencing. And then just the emergence of gene therapies, Vyjuvek getting approved last year. That, I think, has been a huge improvement in the dystrophic EB patients, and I think this just the likelihood that we'll get more gene therapies and other types of corrective therapies coming in the next few years is just it's a very optimistic time right now.
Yeah, I would agree, and I've only been involved in this community for 3 years, and just knowing what I've known from you and the history and what we've experienced being in the community, I'm just so grateful for you and everyone who is like you, working so hard on EB, getting the science and everything to a point where we are now, where there is a lot of optimism moving forward. I'm really excited for what's coming, and I'm really thankful that you even took the time in your busy day to speak with us to get a different message out there for people to hear.
Well, it's my pleasure to help out and to participate. So thank you for having me.
Absolutely.
Thank you, Peter. This has been great. It's so rewarding to know that we can all do something with the journey for a cure for EB. If you're asking yourself, but how can I help? Then you've come to the right place. Wouldn't that feel amazing to know you were helping families just like Ann and Joe's, helping families around the world? Hallieflies.com. That's Hallie flies.com. Hallieflies.com. Every donation gets us closer. How else can you help? Share this episode with someone you know. We are more hopeful than ever that a much-needed cure is in reach.